Hello and welcome to Inside Briefing, the podcast from the Institute for Government. I'm Hannah White. Unedifying and embarrassing, and ultimately deeply damaging for Parliament. The fallout from Wednesday's chaotic scenes in the Commons when MPs descended into political game-playing and procedural rows in a debate on a conflict in which thousands are dying is only just the beginning. The Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, is fighting for his job. But the damage this causes to Parliament may be more significant. We'll reflect on what's happened and what happens next. Then from trouble in Parliament to problems with government. Is the centre of government equipped to meet the urgent challenges that face this country in the 21st century? And if not, how can it be fixed? Well, these are the questions the Institute for Government's Commission on the Centre of Government has been examining for the last 12 months. And in a few weeks' time, we'll be publishing our final report. We'll set the scene. Talking of problems, Rishi Sunak has a few. Recent by-election defeats have ratcheted up the pressure on the PM. Though this week, it's Kemi Badenoch, his business secretary, and someone often tipped as a future Conservative leader who has been in the headlines. We'll take a look at Sunak's standing and those of the people who might want to succeed him. Joining me today is my IFG colleague and the mastermind of our Centre Commission, Alex Thomas. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Hannah. Along with several other colleagues, I should say, indeed, Jordan Urban, Rhys Klein and others.
And I'm delighted that we're joined again by Henry Hill, Deputy Editor of Conservative Home.
Hello.
Hi, Henry. So there's only one place to start today's podcast, I think, and that's with the extraordinary scenes we saw in Parliament last night. I'll do my best to do a little explainer. The Speaker, Lindsay Hoyle, broke with precedent when he selected a Labour amendment to an SNP motion calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. This was on an SNP Opposition Day debate, one of only three that they get in a parliamentary year. And on an opposition day, normally the motion put down by the opposition party, in this case the SNP motion, would be voted on first. Then you would have a vote on the government amendment, which would be criticising the motion from the opposition party. But on this occasion, Labour had also put down an amendment because it didn't want its MPs to have to vote on the SNP wording. Hoyle, breaking with precedent, selected Labour's amendment, which, and I quote, notes that Israel cannot be expected to cease fighting if Hamas continues with violence. Following me so far? The point at which he announced this break with precedent, which is also worth noting, his chief advisor, the clerk of the House, had given him written advice telling him was a break with precedent. Parliament essentially descended into chaos. We saw SNP and Conservative MPs walking out of the chamber, serious criticism of the Speaker, impugning his impartiality in allowing this Labour vote. Hoyle wasn't in the chamber at the time, but he returned to apologise and now there's a mounting number of signatories to a motion of no confidence in him. Henry, it's all a bit unedifying, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, personally, I think that the theatre and everything else is fine. It's always slightly tedious when this kind of thing happens and you get these pearl clutching about, oh, we need massive overhaul and constitutional reform, because obviously a codified constitution would have details of the legislative standing orders in it. But it was a big miscalculation by Lindsay Hoyle. It's unusual that I am ever in the SNP's corner on anything, but they were entirely right to feel aggrieved. They only get, I think you said, three opposition days a year. That is precisely an opportunity for them to foreground their own agenda and indeed to play political games. Both of their motions were designed to embarrass Labour, and that's fine. You can think that opposition days are perhaps pointless theatre, I've written that before, but if you're going to have them, then you should do them properly. And what appears to have happened is Lindsay Hoyle basically tore up the rule book, bowed to pressure from the Labour Party to let Labour hijack the SNP's Opposition Day debate in order to get Keir Starmer and his party out of a tricky spot. Now, that is just not the way that you can behave. I mean, you can behave that way in the chair, but you shouldn't. But you know, we saw this with John Bercow when he used to play fast and loose with the rule book in accordance to his personal sense of what was right or convenient in the moment. And I think that the only thing that really needs to be said about that is that he gave an interview after he left office where he said that Commons had got stronger and stronger over the course of his premiership, and then he left and all of that had been undone. And of course it had, because he had replaced the rules with himself. And then he left. So Speaker Hoyle did look like a step back in the right direction and has been. And I have a lot of respect for him personally, because when I was campaigning to get a commemorative shield for Sir Henry Wilson, an assassinated MP who had been left off the wall of the House of Commons, it took about 2 days from Speaker Hoyle hearing about the campaign to agreeing to put that in. So I have great respect for him personally, but this was clearly a dereliction of his duty as chair, and he compounded it by then refusing to return to the House of Commons and leaving a deputy speaker to explain his decision.
Yeah, I mean, that really did inflame matters, I think. It is up to the speaker to try to facilitate debate. It shouldn't be the case that Commons procedure inhibits the House from being able to have the debates and make the decisions it wants to make. And if there is a way that you can, with cross-party agreement, flex procedure in a way which enables the House to make those decisions, then I think it is for the Speaker to do that. That procedure shouldn't be set in aspic. But the key thing, and it goes back to what you were saying about John Bercow, Henry, is you can't do it as Speaker unless you have secure cross-party agreement to do it, to change that procedure. Let's face it, the procedure does need adapting for a world in which we often have a third party in the Commons. It's designed for a very binary position where you have two main parties and no significant third, fourth, fifth parties. But this wasn't the way to do it.
Well, it was a reform in completely the opposite direction. Because if you were going to be reforming the system to give more weight to minor parties, one of the things that you would start by doing is respecting the opposition debates that they already have, right? This is if anything, it's not just not the way to do it. It's a big step backwards, because this was precisely the Speaker privileging one of the big two parties over the third party.
Well, I think that there was a path which he saw in which it would have helped the SNP. So the idea, I think, was how it was supposed to work was that the Labour amendment would be moved and voted on, that it would be voted down because the government would have the votes to do that. You would then have moved to the SNP motion, which would have been unamended, and they could have had their vote. That could have been voted down, and then you could have had the government amendment. So everybody could have had a vote on their motion in their terms. Where it fell down, I think, is because the government, for whatever reason, pulled out of that pact, realised it couldn't get the votes to defeat the Labour amendment, and decided instead to walk out. And so I think the Speaker was trying to allow all three parties to have their say. Alex, what do you think about all this?
What do I think? It was unedifying, and it's particularly unedifying on a subject like this, where there are incredibly serious debates and discussions to be had, both about the situation in the Middle East and the situation in our country, on our streets, in the Labour Party, in the other political parties. You know, all of those things are really fundamental to politics and to how we're governed, and to have to, you know, go through the brilliant but quite long and convoluted explanation that you did, Hannah, to sort of explain to people why all of this exploded last night is, to use that word again, unedifying. That said, the procedure is it's the rules of the game, and politics happens. And political parties and political actors, of course, they game procedure. Of course, they spot an opportunity and they use this. So to some extent, I completely agree that I do think there's a very strong case. And I think the Speaker's now said he'll go to the Procedure Committee, which looks at these things, to try and overhaul these rules, to try and better facilitate the debate happening in Parliament so that the debate can be had and then votes can be had on things that matter and are meaningful. But politicians are always going to try and prosecute their agenda by using and manipulating the rules of the game. And, you know, to Henry's point about a written constitution or anything about Erskine May and the rules of the House of Commons, that is always kind of used as part of these things. What seems to have happened here is the SNP thought we can put Labour in a difficult position. Their interests aligned with those of the Conservative Party. That did put Labour in a difficult position. Labour found a way out of it by making representations to the Speaker, which happens all the time. I mean, I agree the Speaker probably shouldn't have acted in the way he did, but that happens all the time. That's not that unusual. I don't think we should criticise Labour for making that case. And then the Conservatives thought, oh my goodness, what can we do here? There are some suggestions that maybe they had some MPs peeling off as well, which would be embarrassing for them. Let's blow the whole thing up and try. So it's politics in real time. That's fine. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't try and improve the rules. The other thing, which we haven't yet touched on, is the sort of questions around security of MPs and so on, which, again, another slightly depressing aspect of this is that really serious point has got mixed up in all of this kind of arcane debate. I do think it's really damaging. I'm not sure there was a lot that could be done yesterday, but I do think it's really damaging if the subjects that are debated and the way they're debated in the House of Commons needs to be modified in some way because of risks to MP security or what might happen on the streets. That seems like a very dangerous road that we should go down. I think the Speaker made a mistake in trying to justify this based on the security of MPs. If he'd made the case you made, Hannah, that this is about allowing Parliament to have a debate in the best possible way, I think he would have been on stronger ground than he has been. Will he be removed? Probably not. I think it suits the government to have a slightly chastened Speaker. I think obviously Labour aren't going to remove him. The Conservative Party might also think, we may well be in opposition soon. Do we really want to set this precedent? I suspect Hoyle will limp on, but I might be proved wrong very rapidly.
Henry, what do you make of the security point? That was what Lindsay Hoyle said, was that he wanted to enable these three different motions to be voted on because of concerns around MPs' security. It seems a very odd position to me that we should think that it's parliamentary procedure which should manage those threats rather than either the actions of political parties or the police or the House authorities.
Yeah, well, it's fairly abject reasoning. Because notwithstanding, you're right, it's a very strange forum in which to try and manage those threats. It's also allowing those threats to work. Basically, the signal that Speaker Hoyle sent yesterday to the many people who are apparently threatening MPs over this issue is that, yeah, that threat will change the proceedings in the House of Commons. And I think it's actually been very dispiriting to see Labour MPs, some of whom I respect, coming out of yesterday going, the main thing is that Parliament has voted for a unilateral ceasefire, none of the rest of it matters, because it's just that they again are saying to the very people who from whom we really need to be protecting our democratic procedures, if we're blunt about it, that, yeah, they got what they wanted. They threatened MPs. Those MPs used that to strong-arm the Speaker. There are also suggestions from Nick Watt at Newsnight that Labour threatened to unseat the Speaker after the election if he didn't give them what they wanted. We don't know if that's true, but Nick Watt is tweeting it. And it's a really deplorable state of affairs. It's not unique to this particular situation. One thinks back to the negotiations over Brexit, where people were pleading against establishing any kind of border in Northern Ireland on the basis that dissident Republicans might attack it. That was equally deplorable. The whole point of the peace process was supposed to be that we didn't give men with guns any additional unwarranted say in our politics. So it's not something that I think we can lay entirely at the Speaker's feet. But if he should have sent the opposite signal, he should have stood up there, and he could have, and said, this House will not be moved by threats. He could have made exactly the point you make, that MPs need more security and all the rest of it, but the threat of violence to MPs should absolutely not lead to significant changes in the operation of the House of Commons, especially not this sort of change, which is not an agreed change by all the parties, but as you say, basically chicanery at the last minute, which left two of the three main parties involved in yesterday's debates rightly furious that the rules were apparently being rewritten on the fly to suit one party.
Alex, does anyone come out of this well?
No, not really. That's an easier one. I mean, I think to Henry's point, I think the SNP can feel like they've been poorly treated, and I think they behaved quite kind of properly. But equally, the sort of issue the SNP that benefits the SNP is to feed a grievance and an unhappiness with the way that Westminster operates. So this gives them another weapon in that argument.
I mean, I think the officials came out of it not badly.
Yes,
actually,
yes, that's
true. They did make use of that procedure designed to establish when something which was being done was unprecedented. I mean, it may have been designed to make the case that Hoyle wanted made, about why he was doing it in part, but it was there setting out without any sort of, the needs of people like us to come on the airwaves and explain it, what the precedents were and how something different was being done.
Mm. And I think Lindsay Hoyle, it seemed to me there's been a sort of slight erosion in Lindsay Hoyle's authority anyway. I mean, we watch, because we're in the Westminster bubble, we watch Prime Minister's Question Time more often than normal people do. And the number of times he sort of threatens to chuck MPs out of the chamber and then doesn't actually follow through with that and kind of tries to impose himself, there is a sort of, maybe there's a shifting sands in terms of his role. And certainly that procedure came in off the back of the things that Henry was talking about around the Brexit controversies. Lindsay Hoyle introduced it. It seemed at the time like it might be a way to kind of get the Speaker off the hook. What it's actually done now is expose in a really stark way divisions between, leave the Speaker out on a limb, basically saying, yeah, this one's on me. And so he is very personally exposed.
Okay, Let's turn to how government works. It's 2024, and the UK's centre of power still operates from a central London Georgian townhouse. A dominant treasury, drawing up budgets at least every 6 months, is a few metres away. The Cabinet Office, a department with a massively wide reach but ever-shifting responsibilities and debatable influence, is further up the road. Cabinet ministers squeeze around a large oak table to try and thrash out how to deliver what the country needs. Priorities come and go. Short-term pressures take hold. Levers of power invariably turn out to be made of rubber. Alex, quick plug. Tell us about the Commission for the Centre of Government.
Yes, so this is something we've been doing, which Hannah, you've been chairing with Anthony Seldon as the deputy chair and a group of commissioners over the last year or so to look at the centre of government. And by that, we mean number 10, the Cabinet Office and the Treasury, and particularly the relationships between the three of those based on the, you know, the clear kind of view that the centre of government really matters. We do talk about it a lot, but that's because it has influence and what it, the decisions that are made there really radiate out across the rest of government and the whole public sector and society, and also that it hasn't been working as well as it should have been over the last few years. Prime ministers haven't always been supported in doing the job that they need to do. The COVID inquiry showed up all sorts of kind of gaps in how the Cabinet Office was able to respond to that crisis. And there's been a long-standing debate about the role and influence of the Treasury. So we wanted to take a really forensic look at this with our commissioners and through a series of evidence sessions and interviews that we've been doing with interesting people over the course of the last year.
And who are our commissioners?
Our commissioners are a good group of people. Some people, when we launched it, said, well, actually, you haven't got that many people who've worked in the centre of government or in former number 10 principal private secretaries and that kind of stuff. And that was deliberate because we talked to all those people all the time. We wanted to choose some people who are slightly different, a little bit outside the norm. So we have got some of the great and the good, but also people like Professor Matthew Juniper, who's a Cambridge professor involved in AI and technology as well as engineering. Karen von Hippel, who heads RUSI, the other think tank. Ben Warner, who was in number 10 doing data and analytical work under Boris Johnson. Wendy Williams, who has done lots of work on the Home Office and Windrush, Lawrence Friedman on national security, all sorts of people like that. I won't go through all of them, but interesting people. Sajid Javid is a former chancellor. I'll throw him in at the end.
I mean, our diagnosis is that given the massive, urgent, complicated problems facing the country, not just this government, but any government won't be able to make progress unless they have a wholesale shift in approach to the way they set up the centre.
Yeah, so I'll do a bit of a tease on the problems. I won't go into all of it because I don't want to give the game away before we publish the thing and launch it next month. I'd pick out five key kind of problem areas. One is a strategy gap at the centre of government. Prime ministers and their governments not translating their manifestos and the agenda on which they're elected into a meaningful programme of government that sets priorities and has a clear sense of direction. Another is overlapping and conflicting remits, particularly between number 10 and the Cabinet Office, teams doing similar things and tripping over each other, and therefore being less effective than they might be and causing resentment and confusion inside the centre. The dominance of the Treasury, not necessarily a bad thing if you want fiscal discipline and so on, but a Treasury that is not always as aligned as it should be to that collective programme for the government. The Prime Minister, who in practice, you know, like it or hate it, has become an executive leader of government and in various different ways isn't supported to do that job with this pretty small number 10 that exists at the moment. And then a traditional IFG theme about the civil service and a lack of external scrutiny and pressure on the civil service, misunderstandings of what the responsibilities of the civil service are and how it needs to reform to improve. So those are some of our kind of problem diagnoses, and I'll save the solutions for when we talk about it after the launch.
Henry, what do you think? Is it fair to say that prime ministers, whatever their own strengths and weaknesses, have been let down by the centre?
Yes. I think that in some ways the Prime Minister and the centre has been let down by the lack of central grip, if you like. They have tried, successive Prime Ministers, it's not been helped by the constant chopping and changing of Prime Ministers and goals, I think, and personnel. So even with the perfect administrative setup in the centre, I think the last few years would probably have been incredibly destructive and not very productive. But one thinks of Liz Truss gutting the Downing Street Legislation Unit essentially on a whim, and the obvious implications that would have had for her agenda if she'd had time to have one. And you can see where there is clearly scope for reform. I think my suspicion is that some of the reforms would best be done informally. So, for example, Cabinet. Cabinet has more or less moved to becoming what Bagehot would have called a part of the dignified constitution at this point. Its role is largely performative. It's far too big. The emphasis is mainly on getting as many people around the table as possible. And naturally, that means that actual decision-making is done elsewhere, because you simply cannot have a body that big as an effective decision-making body in the way that cabinet is classically conceived of. I think that the danger of formalizing that more tight-knit group of people around the prime minister and turning them into an official institution with a name and a secretariat and all the rest of it is that there is a danger that that then becomes subject to exactly the same pressure over time that cabinet did. People advocating for this or that random portfolio to be elevated to the inner cabinet or whatever is a sign of seriousness. You'd have the media scrutinizing the gender balance and so on, and politicians sort of elevating more random people in order to try and make sure that they've got an adequate number of this, that, or the other seated around the table. So my personal theory of the secret of effective government is that often it is quite secretive and it doesn't have a name and it just ticks along behind the scenes. So more effective decision making, yes, but the more you formalize that, the more I think that you risk subjecting it to the exact same process of entropy that has sadly befallen the existing structures of government in the center. But I certainly agree, as you guys know, I'm a big fan of the wielding of power from the center. But if prime ministers are going to do it, then they certainly need to make sure that they actually have the machinery in place to make sure that they can do it effectively. Because otherwise, you sort of end up with the worst of both worlds. You end up with a power-hungry center, if you like, that is very controlling and therefore acts as a great block on activity and is a great bottleneck on government performance. But at the same time, is not actually capable of properly scrutinizing and managing the size of government, given the sheer scope of the state today. So we see this when prime ministers, successive prime ministers, like Boris Johnson and so on, they haven't really been prepared to appoint so-called big beasts to departments and give them a lot of leeway. They've been very controlling over the already too small political staff that ministers get. And that has led to, you know, limited political control over departments. It's led to real trouble translating the government's nominal agenda into legislation or regulation or anything else. And you see the results of this time and time again. So I think that a clearer division of responsibility, if you like, between what is actually the Prime Minister's or Downing Street's remit, and then what is the ministerial remit. Because actually, provided the Prime Minister's pick ministers responsibly, and ultimately there is no way to institutionally design your way out of the need for Prime Ministers to do that, political personnel is absolutely essential. That could even strengthen Prime Ministerial oversight, because they would have an empowered viceroy, if you like. They'd have an empowered force in the departments, able to report back and see the will of the government done more effectively than we have at the moment.
Yeah, and completely agree on that point about personnel and the effectiveness and the talents and skills of individuals. And we do talk a bit about that, but equally, sitting in a think tank report, you can't just sort of keep repeating yourself saying, please appoint the best people, because completely agree with that. I think to Henry's point on we've said often, we've got a highly centralized country that has a very weak center. I think one of the things that struck us over the course of the last year doing this work is that really does lead to a sort of micro accumulation of things that a prime minister in the moment cares about. So you get all of these things kind of drawn to the center, which to my mind is a function of the weakness of the center. So I would hope also that a stronger center that is setting direction, and again, we will say a bit more about this in the coming weeks, but is setting direction gives a prime minister confidence then to delegate out, not just to ministers and departments, but also to, all these other kind of actors, local authorities or whoever, who might be better able to prosecute that government agenda.
Okay, exciting stuff. Alex, when is the report out, and tell us about the launch?
11th of March, lunchtime, 12:30. Check out our website shortly. You'll be able to live stream it there. We're really pleased. We've got two former prime ministers who are helping us launch it. We've got John Major and Gordon Brown, who will be at the launch kicking things off and giving their thoughts. And then we will kind of reflect on some of the issues we've talked about today and some of the solutions on the 11th.
Excellent. Let's turn our attention to what's been going on this week. Aside from procedural shenanigans, Rishi Sunak is temporarily taking a back seat as Kemi Badenoch hogs the headlines. Henry, what has the business secretary been up to?
Essentially, there's a massive row going on between Kemi Badenoch and the now departed chair of the post office about the circumstances of his departure and whether or not the government, you know, formally or informally instructed him to go slow on compensation to sub-postmasters because, you know, we're in the run-up to an election and it was allegedly a relatively easy outgoing that they could squeeze or slow down in order to try and save money. Now, Badenoch has come out fighting incredibly strongly, it has to be said. She's one of the more pugilistic members of the front bench, and she has told the House of Commons that this is categorically not the case, and that actually the then chair of the post office was faced allegations of bullying and all the rest of it, which he very strongly denies in turn. Now, you know, a lot of this is just normal political back and forth, but I think that given Badenoch's statement to the House, the really interesting question is whether or not the chair of the post office did or did not receive any advice or instruction to go slow on the sub-postmaster's compensation. Because if he did, and she denied it to the House of Commons, then she has misled the House of Commons. And based on what we've seen in recent times, that puts her in a very difficult position indeed. And this could potentially have big implications for the future of the Conservative Party, because as it stands, with the party looking set, barring a miracle, to lose the next general election, she is one of the people who is tipped as a potential future leader of the opposition. So it will be very interesting to see what happens. For what it's worth, my sources from the department have told me that it is absolutely not true, and that Sarah Munby, the then permanent secretary, is going to clarify what she actually said in the meeting which produced the infamous memo. But until we get clarification on that, there is a question mark hanging over Kemi Badenoch's political future. For what it's worth, I think given the sheer strength of the response that I've been getting from government, I think she's probably confident that she can fight it out, but it will be very interesting to see how it develops.
And Alex, as Henry says, there's a senior civil servant involved in this too.
Yes, shows the importance of good record keeping, doesn't it? As the, you know, former civil servant in me would be bound to say. Yes, Sarah Munby, as Henry said, was the permanent secretary, the top civil servant at the BEIS, the business department that was responsible for the post office before she moved in that kind of machinery of government reshuffle that we had near the start of last year to become the permanent secretary at the science and technology department, DSIT. It's been made public. She's written a very strong, for in civil service terms, letter addressed to Kemi Badenoch, basically setting out her side of the story and saying that, yes, she did have an introductory meeting with Henry Staunton. They talked about a variety of things, and she makes clear from her perspective that discussion of financial matters was a general discussion about relationships with the Treasury, the nature of the departmental budgets as a whole. I think Staunton was arguing for more money to be allocated to certain things, and she was explaining the context, and that was difficult. So that's her story. She's also then published a kind of new note, but she says it's based on records that her private office made at the time. So she's come out, you know, strongly on that as well. I mean, the thing that clearly makes all of this resonate is not just that there's a question of misleading the House of Commons or whatever, it's that this has become a hugely resonant, incredibly kind of publicly salient question. And so any suggestion, and I assume this is why Badenoch, aside from her kind of pugilistic character, has come out so strongly, any suggestion that a government minister was going slow on these kind of compensation payments would be absolutely politically toxic. It is one of a large number, to go to the actual issue, it's one of a large number of kind of compensation questions that are in the mix at the moment. There are eye-watering sums that might be going to, you know, quite rightly, but going to victims of the contaminated blood scandal. So again, it's sort of the corollary of all of these inquiries that we've been having is that people are then getting compensated for them, which does create headaches for the government. This is not nominal sums of money. These do kind of add up for the Treasury.
And this isn't the only story, though, Alex, involving ministers and civil servants this week. The Home Secretary's been in the news too.
Yes, James Cleverly has dismissed, he's called David Neil, who's the Chief Inspector of Borders and Immigration. He was stepping down anyway in March, and the government had previously said they weren't going to renew his term in that office, but he's been dismissed, you know, slightly early. Clearly, this has been a sort of toxic relationship that's been brewing for a while. He's been complaining, understandably, that he's produced 15 reports, apparently, about the border that the government has sat on and hasn't published, whereas the government say that he's been talking to the media and has exceeded his remit in that respect. Not totally unusual. These things do happen, particularly with the Home Office, you know, drugs advisory committees and things like that from now and then. But this is a, you know, a big sort of, you know, a responsible position of the Inspector of the Borders. Again, another, talking about political salience, another, you know, incredibly salient issue. I suspect this one will kind of, you know, fade into the background, but it does show just how the Conservative Party and Conservative ministers are, you know, hyper aware of anything around the border, and criticism of how the immigration system is working kind of goes right to the top of the political agenda.
Mm. And Henry, just to go back to what you were saying about Badenoch, Conservative Home keeps an eye on runners and riders for the Conservative leadership, doesn't it? Who else should we be looking out for?
We don't actively keep an eye on runners and riders of the Conservative leadership, just because that would be like keeping a monkey's paw in your drawer. good as Conservative leadership contests are for business, I think it's possible to see too many of them, even as a committed Conservative journalist. So I'm just going to grab our Cabinet League table, because that will be probably the proxy. You've got Penny Mordaunt up there. It's in second place. Badenoch has been top, I think, for a little while, but Penny Mordaunt is up there. And then after that, it's less obvious, because number three in our most recent was Johnny Mercer. And I'm not aware of that many people talking about Johnny Mercer as a future leadership contender. And fourth was Chris Heaton-Harris, who, with the greatest respect to him, definitely isn't. So it really depends on... It's going to be absolutely fascinating if and when the Conservatives lose the election, because they're going to have a huge intellectual reckoning with this period in government, because they've been in office in one form or another for 14 years, and no faction of the Conservative Party is happy with how things have turned out. There isn't a single section of it which thinks that the country has moved substantially more in their direction over that period of time, with the exception of Brexit, which, you know, however badly it was delivered on account of David Cameron's insane decision to hold a referendum in which the government was on the status quo side and refused to plan for the opposite. They, at least, you know, that has happened. But other than that, it has been a truly very ineffective period in office. So on the one hand, you're going to have presumably not Liz Truss, one hopes, but someone from the Liz Truss camp will go forward. Then you'll have Suella Braverman. And there's a big bun fight essentially for the right. And Robert Jenrick, I think, is also on manoeuvres. And the way that Tory leadership contests tend to work, at least in the modern era, is that the structure is that MPs whittle it down to a final two and the final two go to the membership. And what tends to happen is that you get a candidate from the right and then you get a candidate from everywhere else, because it's very rare. I can't actually think of the last time it happened that the left of the party is strong enough to see someone through into the final two on their own steam. So I imagine that we will end up in a position where Penny could potentially be the candidate of the left and centre. Kemi could actually be either of them, which is interesting, because she's very sort of carefully positioned that way. And then it will depend on whether or not someone comes up on the right. So, for example, if someone like Suella or Robert Jenrick emerges and gets through as the candidate of the right, I think Kemi could probably edge Mordaunt to be the candidate of the rest of the centre and the left, because she would have more right-wing credibility and she might be more likely to beat that person. If Kemi emerges as the candidate of the right, then that leaves, I think, Penny Mordaunt probably as the front runner to go through to the final two.
Very, very interesting. And on that note, we'll bring this week's podcast to an end. Thank you so much to Alex Thomas and especially to Henry Hill. Thank you all for listening to this episode. You can find all our podcasts, including our brilliant new 6-part series, Preparing for Power, at Acast, Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. And a quick plug now for next week's Expert Factor. It's a budget preview special. Remember to subscribe and do leave us a review. There are so many exciting IFG events coming up, including that Centre Commission launch with John Major and Gordon Brown. You can find out more about all of them on our website and do sign up to join us. Look out too for our new paper on standards, as well as all our budget coverage. It's probably worth checking out our explainers on the role of the speaker too. It's a busy time, isn't it? Enjoy the weekend, everyone.